During our study in the Psalms, we've learned about the structure of many Psalms. And perhaps the shape that we've seen the most as we've gone through the book so far is that of an hourglass. You all know that. I bring it up here and set it right here. And we realize that the Psalm is funneling to the very center and giving us the main point. But there's also another shape that we've encountered a few times, and I think it's good to highlight it because this Psalm takes the shape of successive waves. You may feel like that in your life, that life is a series of going from one test to another. And this psalm is really structured like that. It goes to the crest of a wave of trust in the love of the Lord, and then it goes down once again into another trough of distress. We see that three times here in this psalm, three successive waves of trust in distress. And at the height of each wave, what's motivating us through all of our trouble is the steadfast love of the Lord. In Hebrew, it's the word chesed. It speaks of his loyal covenant love to his promises that he's made to his people. And it focuses on his relationship, the faithfulness God has in his relationship to us. David's focus on the love of the Lord is so powerful in this psalm, in fact, that it's on the lips of Jonah when he's in the belly of the whale. We find it quoted on the lips of Jeremiah, the prophet, and then finally on the lips of Jesus on the cross. So what did they discover about the love of the Lord that we should know in times of distress? Well, notice the first thing. This psalm teaches us that we should trust in the love of the Lord when caught in a tight place. This first wave begins with a desperate, urgent tone. And we're going to find out that David is in narrow straits, a tight place that few of us have ever experienced. His desperate prayer to the Lord teaches us to take refuge in his righteousness. Look at verses 1 and 2 in Psalm 31 with me. David begins by saying, "In you, O Lord, do I take refuge. Let me never be put to shame. In your righteousness, incline your ear to me. Rescue me speedily. Be a rock of refuge for me, a strong fortress to save me." Now, why was David in such a tight place? What were the circumstances he was facing? We don't know for sure, but there is one story in the life of David that fits really well with this psalm, and we find it in 1 Samuel 23. Now, they told David, "Behold, the Philistines are fighting against Keilah and are robbing the threshing floors. Therefore, David inquired of the Lord, 'Shall I go and attack these Philistines?' And the Lord said to David, 'Go and attack the Philistines and save Keilah.' But David's men said to him, 'Behold, we are afraid here in Judah. How much more then if we go to Keilah against the armies of the Philistines?' Then David inquired of the Lord again. And the Lord answered him, 'Arise, go down to Keilah, for I will give the Philistines into your hand.' And David and his men went to Keilah and fought with the Philistines and brought away their livestock and struck them with a great blow. So David saved the inhabitants of Keilah." This town, Keilah, was close to the border between Israel and the land of the Philistines. It was a border town that was under constant threat of being raided by the Philistines, and it was also very close to Bethlehem and Judah. So it's kind of a crucial strategic military point for protecting the people of Israel. And David is still constantly being hunted by Saul in this story. So even as he runs from Saul, he asks the Lord what he should do about his own people who are being robbed of their food. And God says to David, "Go deliver them." So David does the people of Israel and Saul, his own king, who's hunting him down, favor by defeating and plundering the Philistines. But Saul had zero gratitude. Instead, Saul sees this as an opportunity to get rid of David once and for all. So the story continues. When Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, had fled to David to Keilah, he had come down with an ephod in his hand. An ephod was just the way in the Old Testament they used of discerning what God's will was, what God wanted them to do. Now it was told Saul that David had come to Keilah, and Saul said, "God has given him into my hand, for he has shut himself in by entering a town that has gates and bars." And Saul summoned all the people of war to go down to Keilah to besiege David and his men. What a kind thank you to David and his men for all their service to the kingdom. David sees him as trapped in a corner, or Saul sees David as trapped in a corner. And it's in this context that David makes a desperate plea to the Lord. Then the anchor of David's plea is found in verse 1. We saw it. He said that the Lord is righteous. God will not overlook the trouble of his children. You know, David had often taken refuge in the rocks of the hills and far off mountain fortresses. But he knew behind all of those physical realities was a spiritual reality that God was his fortress and ultimately God would take care of him. You know, we often forget about the spiritual realities in this world when we get so focused on our present physical trouble. We focus on what we can see. There's a photo taken back in 2015 that captures a lot of how we respond to trouble in life. There are some celebrities that were walking down a red carpet, and notice all the people trying to focus on their phones, trying to capture the moment. But then there's that one lady in the front. They're just completely enjoying the moment. And so many times we're like the crowd. We know God is working through our trouble, but we get obsessed with what's right in front of us rather than on God, who is our refuge, on the one behind all this. Be like that older lady who focused on the main point of what was happening in the moment. Focus instead of on God and cultivate an instinctive reflex, not to look at your trouble in front of you, but on God who is at work behind it. Turn to God in prayer whenever you are caught in a tight place. Notice how David does this. He teaches us to commit ourselves to the Lord's name. Look at verse 3. He says, "For you are my rock and my fortress, and for your name's sake, you lead me and guide me. You take me out of the net they have hidden for me, for you are my refuge." This prayer is a laser beam focus on who God is for David. He says, "He is righteous. He is our rock. He is our fortress. He is our guide. He is our refuge. He is our Savior." And because he is all these things, when he saves us, he gets glory. It's all about God. And he's the only one who can get glory in this way. If you and I claim to deliver ourselves or be able to save other people, it would be arrogant boasting. But it's not boasting with God, because it's true of God. God can make this claim because he alone is worthy of this kind of trust. It's appropriate and fitting. So David commits himself to God in verse 5. Notice it. He says, "Into your hand I commit my spirit. You have redeemed me, O Lord, faithful God." And that word "redeemed" in the context means to be delivered from distress. David's talking about very real deliverance from his trouble. You know, David could be confident looking forward into the future that God would save him. Or maybe he's looking to the past of how God had delivered him in the past. But either way, this is a cry of absolute faith and dependence on God that God will take care of him. David trusted God. And the fullest meaning of these words we find cried out by Jesus when he was on the cross. We're told in Luke 23, "It was now about the sixth hour, and there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour, while the sun's light failed. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Then Jesus, calling out with a loud voice, said, 'Father, into your hands I commit my spirit.' And having said this, he breathed his last." You know, Jesus, the Son, entrusted himself to God the Father when he died on the cross. And this wasn't some kind of passive trust, kind of a giving up of himself. No, Jesus willingly gave up his life for you and for me. So Jesus said in John chapter 10, "For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I may take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again. This charge I have received from my Father." Jesus willingly laid down his life for you and for me. And we know what happened after that. He was buried, and then he rose as a vindication of his sacrifice for you and for me. He went before us to the cross, to the grave, and then the skies. So today, if you are in a tight place, look to Jesus. Jesus has gone on before us in ways we could never imagine and faced the cross, the grave, and then raised to the skies to encourage us to trust in God's love and commit ourselves to him when we are in a tight place. You know, God leads us often down difficult paths, but they are good paths if you trust in him. You can walk your difficult but good path knowing Jesus walked it before you. Beneath all of this is God's steadfast love. And so David tells us that we can rejoice in his steadfast love. And this is really the crest of that first wave. We see David's distress and his anxiety and his trouble. But what motivates his faith is God's love for him. And we see it in verse 6. David expresses his joy in the Lord's love with a stunning contrast. It's not how we'd expect it. He says, "I hate those who pay regard to worthless idols, but I trust in the Lord." You know, just last week in Psalm 139, we saw how David expressed his passion for the Lord in similar terms. And this really challenges our cultural assumptions that tolerance is always a virtue. David says he hates them. You know, Jesus had very strong words for proud people like the Pharisees. He didn't tolerate their arrogance. And David will not tolerate the idolatry of wicked men. In October of 2015, our nation was stunned by the mysterious kidnapping of a young girl named Jamie Kloss. After shooting and killing both of her parents at night, 21-year-old Jake Patterson evaded the police and took her 70 miles north to a home in rural Wisconsin. Patterson later told authorities the reason he did it was because he saw Jamie getting off a bus one day, and he knew that she was the girl he wanted to take. Does that story repulse you? There is an appropriate response to the heinousness of sin that instinctively wells up inside of us. And the gospel of forgiveness is extended to Patterson, but until he repents, he is under God's wrath, just like any sinner. Until they humble themselves, God never flinches in the face of evil. He never backs down. So David hates wicked men. He refuses to take up sides with them or tolerate their evil ways. And notice the emphatic contrast. He says, "I hate wicked men, but," in the second half of verse 6, "I trust in the Lord." What anchors his trust is the steadfast love of the Lord. He continues in verse 7. He says, "I will rejoice and be glad in your steadfast love." And why? Why? What does God's love mean for him? He says, "Because you have seen my affliction. You know the distress of my soul." Do you believe that? Do you believe that God sees your affliction and knows your distress? You know, I'm sure that Jamie Kloss wished and hoped day after day that someone would see and know her. Trapped with seemingly no one to deliver, escape seemed impossible to her. And sometimes it might feel like for you, you might feel like this today. I don't know what your situation is, but I know this happens to God's people. You may feel like your prayers are just bouncing off the ceiling. Like, where are you, God? Do you see me? Do you know me? And the truth is, God is always at work. He is never oblivious to our trouble. So David affirms this in verse 8. He says, "And you have not delivered me into the hand of my enemy. You have set my feet in a broad place." This is transaction terminology. Like when you hand the cashier the money and they give you the item that you're purchasing. God could have handed David over to his enemies, but instead he takes him from a tight place and leads him to a broad place. This is what God had done for David. In the case of Jamie Kloss, after 88 days of captivity, she escaped when Patterson was gone from the home and was discovered by a shocked neighbor lady who was walking her dog through the neighborhood. Jamie was free. She was safe. She was rescued out of a tight place. You know, that's a heavy story, and I don't say it to be overly gratuitous, overly descriptive or anything. I want to make the point that we're repulsed by evil, but we are safe in God's love. I believe with all my heart that God can deal with even the heaviest problems we face in this world because his love is stronger than anything we face. That it really is a huge struggle for so many Christians. It's a huge struggle for some of you to believe that God sees and he knows and he hears your trouble, but he does. And this psalm was written that you might trust in his love. And it's easy to believe in the moment. You know, you hear an inspiring sermon or some kind of truth that encourages you, but then the second wave comes, right? The trials continue on. As the temptations grow more difficult, what do you do? Well, David shares with us his experience in the second wave. In the psalm, we learn that the answer is the same. He tells us to trust in the love of the Lord when betrayed to a lonely place. Here's the next trial for David, loneliness. The world is full of lonely people. There are a lot of reasons for why that is the case. Possibly the cell phones we saw up on the screen a few minutes ago. Many other things, but sometimes, sadly, it's our own fault. We mess up. Our sin causes damage in this life. And David acknowledges that reality in verses 9 to 10. He reminds us that we're sinners, that we need to seek God's grace. Notice in verse 9, he says, "Be gracious to me, O Lord, for I am in distress. My eye is wasted from grief, my soul and my body also, for my life is spent with sorrow and my years with sighing. My strength fails because of my iniquity, and my bones waste away." David is suffering physically from the consequences of his own sin. You know, sin will do that to you. If you're racked with guilt and unresolved conflict, it can lead to sleeplessness, damaging stress in your body, and so much more. We are embodied souls. The two interact with each other. And David's only hope in the face of his sin is God's grace, his love displayed towards him. So he cries out, "Be gracious to me, O Lord." This is his confession. And in the story of Keilah in 1 Samuel 23, we really don't get any indication of David sinning. So it may not be the exact situation that he's facing. Or there may be more in this story that we don't read about. But what we do know is David was a sinner. Was he not? I mean, he messed up in big ways. And he does it time and time again. But God still loves him. He will not leave his child alone. And you may have someone who does that to you. You've messed up and you know it. Then you try to apologize, but instead of forgiving you, they rub your sin in your face. They say, "Well, you deserve it." They withhold forgiveness. They vindictively spite you. And this psalm is telling you that you rest in God's grace and his forgiveness. When you come to him confessing your sin and repenting, he forgives you by his grace through his love. All who come to him, he will never cast out. Because we're not just sinners. We are also sufferers. Sinners and sufferers. So we can seek God's love. In verses 11 through 16, David's going to mention his enemies and friends who have forsaken him. Yes, he may have sinned, but the problem runs deeper than that. He is a friend of God, and his enemies are going to latch onto any opportunity they have to run him into the ground and cut him off. Notice what happens after David was delivered from the city of Keilah. We're told David knew that Saul was plotting harm against him, and he said to Abiathar the priest, "Bring the ephod here." I mentioned earlier this was the way they discerned what the will of God was in this time in the history of Israel. So David said, "O Lord, the God of Israel, your servant has surely heard that Saul seeks to come to Keilah to destroy the city on my account." Now notice his insight here. He says, Will the men of Keilah surrender me into his hand? He's like, are these people going to betray me? The people I just delivered. Will Saul come down as your servant has heard? Oh Lord, the God of Israel, please tell your servant. And the Lord said, he will come down. So David gets the answer to one of his questions. In spite of all of David's help in conquering the Philistines, Saul is going to come down. He's going to try to capture David because he views this as a great opportunity to get this man he's been hunting for. But sure, the people of Keilah would understand, right? Surely. I mean, Saul's one thing, but David just saved these people from the Philistines, from being plundered. So verse 12, then David said, he repeats the question, will the men of Keilah surrender me and my men into the hand of Saul? It's like building up the suspense in the story. And the Lord said, they will surrender you. Ouch. I mean, talk about betrayal. God tells him that he saved these people and now they have the intent to betray him. This was David's perpetual experience. This wasn't a one-time event. Because David was an unpopular guy, many people didn't want to be associated with him, even his close friends and his companions. So look in Psalm 31. Notice what he says in verse 11. This is no longer David's sin we're talking about. It's his association with God. Because of all my adversaries, verse 11, I have become a reproach, especially to my neighbors, and an object of dread to my acquaintances. Those who have seen me in the street flee from me. I have been forgotten like one who is dead. I have become like a broken vessel. For I hear the whispering of many, terror on every side, as they scheme together against me, as they plot to take my life. The prophet Jeremiah embraced these words in his own ministry as he told the people what God said, and they rejected him. You see, the truth is that there may be many people in your life who will reject you, not because of any sin that you've done, but because of your association with Jesus Christ. Because you love God and are loyal to Him. Do you have family who have forsaken you because of your love for Jesus? It happens often. Perhaps people who won't even speak to you because you've decided to follow Christ. That hurts, doesn't it? Let your suffering point you to Jesus. You know, at Jesus' crucifixion, all his disciples fled. He was betrayed by his own Judas. He was left forsaken, alone on the cross, and he did nothing wrong. Instead, he suffered for your sin and for my sin. Several years ago, my family was at a playground. One of our girls spotted a teeter-totter, a seesaw, whatever you want to call it. And she wanted me to jump on the other side and do it with her. So she got on first. I gingerly got onto the seesaw. And the center of it was anchored by this big tire. So I braced my foot on the tire since, you know, I'm a little bit heavier than she was. And she was fine. You know, we were doing fine for a little bit until my foot slipped off the tire. And I proceeded to launch my daughter off the seesaw, and she came forward, landed on the middle bar, and rolled off. Started crying. So I picked her up, dusted off all the bark from her face, and she was fine after a few minutes. But the point is this. You know, when we're talking about Christianity and some of these really difficult doctrines, it's very important that we balance the truth. We need to keep in mind this truth when we're going through the Psalms or when we're helping people who are in distress, that we are both at the same time sinners and sufferers. If you make too much of your sin and forget to look to God's grace, you can become easily discouraged. You need God's love and forgiveness. But if you make too much of your suffering, you can easily become a victim. As if, I don't deserve all this. God, why are you doing this? And the same is true with other people. As you help them with their sin, you could become overly judgmental. But at the same time, if you help them with their suffering and focus entirely on that, you can become overly permissive. Many times our sin and our suffering are intertwined. It's not simple. It's more complicated. And in both cases, the answer is simple. Look to the love of the Lord. So David says in verse 14, notice it in the Psalm, But I trust in you, O Lord. I say, you are my God. My times are in your hand. Rescue me from the hand of my enemies and from my persecutors. Make your face shine on your servant. Save me in your steadfast love. The second wave of trouble and David's loneliness, because of his sin and because of his suffering, he turns to the steadfast love of the Lord. He begs God to bless him in love. And really, this is a reference to the Aaronic blessing that we read in Numbers chapter 6. There, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, 'Thus you shall bless the people of Israel. You shall say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace, so they shall put my name upon the people of Israel, and I will bless them.'" See how this gives glory to God as God blesses his people, puts his name on them. And what more beautiful words could we use to describe the loyal love of the Lord? David turns to this promise, God's love, in his plea for deliverance. He was in a lonely place. He knew he was frail and weak. His times were in God's hands. So he casts himself on the Lord's love. When you are tested with loneliness, claim these words as God's promise to you. And I'm talking about this blessing I just read. God's promise to his people. Pray this way. Pray, "Lord, please bless me and keep me. Please make your face shine upon me and be gracious to me. Please lift your countenance upon me and give me peace." But don't just do it for yourself. Pray it with other Christians who are in trouble. And do it with them. People who are lonely, who are discouraged, so they know God's presence with them through you. Let me go back to that story about Jamie Kloss and Jake Patterson just one more time, because I'm sure some of you are still unsettled by it. Yes, we're sinners, and yes, we're sufferers, but what about those wicked people who isolate other people and cause immense suffering? I mean, what if Patterson had gotten away with it, as some do? Well, David addresses that too. He doesn't just tell us we're sinners and sufferers. He tells us that we are saints, people God has saved who can seek God's justice. In the face of so much evil, David focuses on his relationship to the Lord, the only one who can do anything about it. And yes, David's the king of Israel, but he's also a saint, just like any of us who believed in God and his promises. So he prays in verse 17. He says, "O Lord, let me not be put to shame, for I call upon you." He doesn't want to be shamed into defeat because he's called on the Lord, and the Lord's name would be shamed. David's name would be shamed if he was defeated. So instead he continues praying, "Let the wicked be put to shame, not me, them. Let them go silently to Sheol," that's like the grave or deep place of the earth. "Let the lying lips be mute in pride and in contempt." Basically, David wants it to stop. Okay, the lies that these people are saying about him, the vicious attacks that are going on towards his character, he's asking God to put them to silence by putting them in the grave. He wants their defeat so that they can never spread their evil lies again, so the judgment is fitting to the crime. And David knows this prayer is appropriate because God loves him and he hates sin. You know, it is right for the Christian to seek God's justice. God never flinches in the face of evil. And we can be guaranteed that if not in this life, then in the next, God will establish justice. So it's possible to pray for those who persecute you, to love your enemies, while at the same time asking that God would establish justice and do the right. Both things are compatible. No one gets away with their crimes. Every wicked deed that has been committed will be punished if we do not repent. So it's a warning, but also a comfort. So Psalm 31 teaches us to trust in the love of the Lord. With every successive wave of distress, God's love is more than able to help us. He helps us when we're caught in a tight place. He helps us when we're betrayed to loneliness. And then notice finally that we can trust in the love of the Lord when stuck in a waiting place. Often our times of relief don't come right away. We have to wait on the Lord. And as we wait, God does three wonderful things in his love. The first thing God does while we wait is he hides us in his goodness. Notice in verse 19 how God does this in the life of David. He says, "Oh, how abundant is your goodness." Now watch the language here. "Which you have stored up for those who fear you and worked for those who take refuge in you in the sight of the children of mankind. In the cover of your presence, you hide them from the plots of men. You store them in your shelter from the strife of tongues." God's abundant goodness is held in reserve for those who trust in him in the midst of their distress. The way you access God's abundant goodness is by trusting in him, committing yourself to him. And when the rest of the children of mankind look on, they see that God is taking care of you in the midst of your trouble, and God gets glory for that. And God's goodness is really far better than we can comprehend. We often think of it as just being hidden. Like David says here, he'll be hidden from the strife of the tongues of men. But there's more here. In 2016, Pastor Andrew Brunson was arrested in Turkey after being charged with espionage. Many of you probably remember that story. And after 2 years of heavy economic pressure from the United States, the Turkish courts released Brunson. You know, when Brunson finally stepped off the airplane onto American soil, two things happened at the same time. He was protected from the plots of men, from all the lies that had been told about him and all the injustice that had happened in those Turkish courts. But then simultaneously, he was welcomed back into America. He was reunited with his family. He went to the White House and met the president and all of those high-ranking officers and people of power who worked for his freedom, protected and blessed. And what this psalm is telling us is that when you wait on the Lord, you're simultaneously protected and blessed. Hidden from the plots of the wicked, safe in the presence of God. You know, in the New Testament, we're told in Colossians chapter 3, verse 3, that your life is hidden with Christ in God. Sheltered from the plots of men, safe in the presence of Jesus, and enjoying all the benefits and the blessings of his love. Both things are true at the same time. But you have to wait on him in faith. God has his goodness stored up for those who fear him and trust in him and take refuge in him. So don't expect a store of goodness from God if you don't run to his refuge. Don't expect Christianity to yield to instant demands like popcorn in the microwave, like God's a genie who just magically gives you what you want. No, you need a relationship with him. To walk closely with him. And when you trust in his love in that waiting place, you find that God helps you in his love. And that's what God did for David in this situation at Keilah. After God tells David that he's going to be betrayed by the inhabitants of the city, he also told him this. We find out that David and his men, who were about 600, arose and departed from Keilah, and they went wherever they could go. When Saul was told that David had escaped from Keilah, he gave up the expedition. Just like that. Saul gave up. For whatever reason, it was too discouraging for him. He's like, it's not worth the effort anymore. And he just leaves. All of David's distress completely settled in just a few moments. And so we read in our psalm that David proclaims to the Lord, "Blessed be the Lord, for he has wondrously shown his steadfast love to me when I was in a besieged city. I had said in my alarm, I am cut off from your sight, but you heard the voice of my pleas for mercy when I cried to you for help." David takes advantage of this moment by blessing the Lord. His trust comes out in praise. He was delivered, and now you see his faith. And this is really a good lesson for us. We move on too quickly from what God has done in our lives. We often have spiritual amnesia because we're going from one wave of distress to the next, and what we fail to do is to stop when God has delivered us and bless him for it. Thank him, like the one of the 10 lepers who came back and praised Jesus. Don't forget and move on from God's deliverance in your life. Instead, look back at what he has done and let build your faith from wave to wave. But notice that these trials will continue in this life, and that's why we need to celebrate God's deliverance. David's trials continue. In verse 14 of the story, we're told, David remained in the strongholds in the wilderness, in the hill country of the wilderness of Ziph, and Saul sought him every day. But God did not give him into his hand. David needed the Lord's loyal love to sustain him every step along the way, because his trouble continued. It wasn't just one and done. He knew that he needed this. But more importantly, David knew that all of us needed this. Notice he tells us that God directs us while we wait, and he makes it a corporate application. He says to all of us what we should do with the psalm. Verse 23, he says, "Love the Lord, all you his saints. The Lord preserves the faithful, but abundantly repays the one who acts in pride. Be strong and let your heart take courage, all you who wait for the Lord." So could it be any more clear what the point of this psalm is? David is saying that God's loved us, so we should in turn love him back. Love him for his deliverance. That word saints literally means people of loving kindness. We become people of love towards God and towards others. Now, what we should not misunderstand these final verses for is a call to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. Yes, it says that we should be strong, let our hearts take courage. It commands us to love the Lord. But what is that based in? What is our love for God based in? The three successive waves where we see his love for us. What God has done compels what we must do. So we don't just love God out of something that we work up in our hearts. We love him because of what he's done for us. So John says it very simply in this way. We love because he first loved us. God has proved his love for you time and time again. And most clearly, he showed it to you on the cross. God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. What a sweet love that calls us to love and empowers us to love all at the same time. What we must do flows out of what God has already done. So trust in the love of the Lord. When you are in a tight place, when you're betrayed to a lonely place, or when you're stuck in a waiting place, trust in the love of the Lord. Let's pray.